Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Gallipoli Club, and we're grateful for the use of this facility where we've got a discussion on political fiction and non-fiction, featuring the work of the late Alan Reid and of Peter Coleman. So we're going to lead off with Ross Fitzgerald, who has edited Alan Reid's so far unpublished novel, The Band of Log. Helen Trinker, Ross is going to speak for 5 minutes about the background. Helen Trinker is going to look at the book as a novel, as a work of fiction. Helen was last here when she wrote her book Madeline, The Life of Madeline St. John, which was the co-winner of the Prime Minister's Literary Awards for Non-Fiction in 2014. Congratulations to Helen on that. And then we're going to go to Peter Coleman, who has recently republished his memoirs of a slow learner. And I'll introduce our three speakers very briefly in the order that they're going to speak. Ross Fitzgerald is a writer and a columnist for The Weekend Australian. Helen Trinker is managing editor of The Australia and editor of The Deal magazine. And Peter Coleman is a writer and a columnist, in particular a columnist for The Spectator Australia. So we'll start with Ross, then Helen, then Peter. Ross, thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The late Alan Reid, who was born in 1914 and died in 1987, was probably the most influential political journalist in 20th century Australia. Working for most of his long career as Canberra correspondent for the Daily Telegraph, Reid not only reported key events in Australian politics, but also from time to time actively participated in them. Apart from his hitherto suppressed novel, The Bandar Log, a Labor story of the 1950s, Alan Reid wrote three major works of non-fiction: The Power Struggle, published in 1969, The Gorton Experiment, published in 1971, and The Whitlam Venture, published in 1976. As Stephen Holt and I pointed out in our biography of Alan the Red Fox Reid, which was shortlisted for the 2011 National Biography Award, Reid's Roman R. Clef, which highlighted the Machiavellian nature of Labor politics in the 1950s, was submitted to Angus and Robertson in 1958. However, Dr. Colin Roderick, who later on became the Professor of English at Townsville, he worked at the time for A&R, and he declared the novel was libelous. As a result, the publisher withdrew its initial support. In 1960, another attempt at publishing The Bandar Log, this time by J.P. Atkins of Cleveland Publishing, also failed. The printer, Halstead Press, a subsidiary of Angus and Robertson, was ordered to halt the print run by its owner company. A celebrated legal case followed. Atkins, who was president of the Democratic Labor Party in New South Wales, sued Halstead for breach of contract. However, in September 1961, Judge Perignon of the Sydney District Court found the novel to be libelous and the claim was dismissed. Indeed, in a legal first, as far as I'm aware, Reid's novel had been judged to be defamatory without having been published. The Bandar Log is a document of considerable historical significance. This is because Reid's novel is a thinly fictionalised recreation of the great Labor split of the 1950s. This schism in Labor ranks began in October 1954 when its erratic Federal Party leader, Dr. Evatt, denounced the perceived influence over the party by that anti-communist Catholic activist, Bob Santamaria. The resulting Donnybrook involved personality clashes as well as ideological conflict. The whole messy saga featured a diverse array of participants, including Catholic churchmen, trade union bosses, state premiers, state and federal Labor politicians, and assorted commentators and journalists. The characters in the Bandalog mirror, with varying degrees of faithfulness, these actual participants in the Labor split. For example, in Reig's novel, the character Kaiser Borgia, which sounds like Caesar Borgia, is clearly Dr. Evatt, while the character Car Domenico is undoubtedly Bob Santamaria. Moreover, the hard-bitten political insider Machiavelli, i.e. Machiavelli, was none other than Reig himself. Fortuitously, and thanks to the diligent and helpful staff of the Mitchell Library in Sydney, I was able to access and copy the 1960 galley proofs of Alan Reid's hitherto unpublished novel. As a rule of thumb, each single galley equaled 3 pages of the manuscript. At Gerrits, the Sydney Institute, Anusha Rutnam digitally converted the old, complicated and arcane typeset manuscript into a relatively readable formula. But a problem was that some of the 1960 galleys were both quite difficult to read and all were overwritten in Reid's own hand. Moreover, in the 1960 version of the Bandalog, Reid literally repeated over and over, "I said, she said, he said, they said, etc." So to make Reid's novel more accessible and readable, a great many of these repetitions were omitted. After I completed the first editing process, Paige Halley then meticulously retyped the manuscript from the original. At this stage, Terry Moriarty's fact-checking and proofreading was extremely helpful. Then after a final edit, Nathan Lenton painstakingly entered all the various corrections into the final manuscript. In the publication of the Bandalog, I'm especially indebted to Alan Reid Jr., who was here with us this evening with his sister Susan McLean, and to the other members of the family of the late Alan Reid. I would also like to thank the family of the late great cartoonist Les Tanner, whose extremely evocative portrait of Alan Reid, which originally appeared on the front of Quadrant magazine, graces the cover of this book. As it happens, it was none other than Peter Coleman, whose memoir we are also celebrating tonight, who was editor of Quadrant at the time, arranged for Les Tanner to draw this portrait of Alan Reid. While Alan Reid's hitherto unpublished Australian Labor novel of the 1950s is hardly War and Peace or Great Expectations, I hope that when you read the Bandalog, you will see why historians like myself and Stephen Holt, along with leading political commentator Laurie Oakes and former journalist now Prime Minister Tony Abbott, thought it important to at last publish the Bandalog for all to read. Thanks indeed for organising this function, Gerard, and thanks indeed for you pressing my publisher, Connor Court, to feature Tanner's brilliant cartoon portrait of Alan Reid on the book's front cover. Thank you.
So now we go to Helen Trinker. Thank you, Helen.
Thank you, Gerard. Actually, I'm just going to mention something before I start. We published in The Australian on Saturday an extract from the book, and after that, I think it was to you, Ross, an email came from a gentleman whose mother had been proofreading the version in 1960 and alerted the publisher to the potential defamation and libel in the book. And apparently in the court case that followed, that woman was called as, and not as an expert witness at the proofreading, but as an ordinary person to sort of prove that if the book was published, an ordinary person would be able to identify, you know, Santa Maria and all and sundry. So I thought that's just a nice little story that history goes on repeating itself, or, you know, we learn more and more. Now, I've been asked to look at this book as a work of fiction, and I must say in this gathering I'm quite pleased that I haven't been asked to verify the facts of it, because with these battalions of people here, many of whom I think are probably Cold War experts, I'm pleased that I don't have to judge its historical accuracy. But of course, the problem with this book is that looking at it as a piece of fiction is almost impossible, because it's a book about very specific historical events written by one of the country's most outstanding journalists. and a man who made his reputation on reporting facts, even though there's a big argument about how much of a player Alan Reid was in politics as well. But in any case, it's difficult to read the Bandar Log as just another novel. Indeed, reading the book, especially the sections where the characters are easy to identify, people like Corwell or Evatt, Sam Berea, John Burton, Gough Whitlam even, one is constantly thinking of the real people and trying to assess the authenticity of the events and their characterisation. You end up measuring Reid's words against the facts. And if, like me, you are no expert on Labour politics in the 1950s, you end up spending quite a lot of time on Wikipedia in order to try to determine the facts. It's an engrossing exercise, but it's very different from reading a more obviously fictitious novel. In the end, I think this book is sort of judged and will be seen as really an important Australian artefact as much as an Australian important Australian novel. None of that takes away from the attractiveness of the book. It does have its flaws, but it's far from a dry or difficult read. The Bandar Log is sometimes gripping, in fact, and almost always interesting. It's a book by a witness to extraordinary events, a witness who in the late 1950s chose to put away his normal sort of rules of engagement, the rules of journalism, and write very freely about the people and the events he'd reported on for years in Canberra. So Reid was armed clearly with plenty of facts and also with plenty of gossip and third-hand information. And so this doyen of the press gallery gives us the best, in some ways, best of both worlds. It's journalism masquerading as fiction, and because we know that the story that Reid is referencing, we're also getting fiction, in a sense, which masquerades as history. So information and imagination blur, and the result, I think, is a book that is a unique contemporary account of events more than half a century ago. Now, you have to read it for yourself to decide where you think the truth of the matter lies, but I think that if you're like me, you'd really enjoy Reid's very powerful writing and his very astute judgments on political tactics and the political class. And certainly for me, my understanding and my sort of interest in the forces in play around that 1954-55 split in Labor is amplified by this book. And the strength of it is really that Reid is writing almost in the heat of the battle. The party's split, the DLP is up and running by the time he puts pen to paper, I think in about 1957-58, clearly. Labor's in trouble, but not very much is decided in national politics, and the dust really has scarcely settled on some extraordinary years that he's lived through. And he really was like a lot of other people, Alan Reid. Politicians, party operators, party faithful, and I guess in a way they've gone through some of the most dramatic years that, of their lives, really, in that period. He'd been very, very close to the action. You'll have to read, I think, Gerard's book on Santa Maria, a forthcoming biography, to find out just how close, I suppose, Reid was in some of the play that went on. He told me a story just before, and he perhaps will repeat it in question time, about just how close Reid was to Evatt. In fact, in this case. When he sits down to write this novel, I think Alan Reid brings to his typewriter his anger and cynicism and really a sense of despair almost and a certain degree of resignation about Labor's crisis and just generally about the sort of dirt and the muck and mire, really, of politics more generally. He recreates conversations he couldn't possibly have heard, of course, between Evatt and about conversations that Evatt has about, for example, Santa Maria and the direction of the party. He invents dialogue that's strong and clear, allows him to say things that he thought went on behind closed doors, and all the more interesting for that. He analyses the players of this Cold War power struggle in ways, of course, it would have been impossible for him to do on the front page of the Daily Telegraph during his career. And he does it all by drawing on years of observation and gossip, as well as a fact-finding. His judgments are pretty tough. Reid was a brilliant and sometimes cruel writer in non-fiction, and he gets even better in some ways, of course, in this book where he doesn't have to, well, at least he thought he didn't have to worry about libelling anyone. He's in this little extract here, I'll just read, he channels Corwell talking about Santa Maria, I guess in the early 50s, before 1954. And he says, my enemies in the party, brackets, Saborgia, I can't pronounce it as well as it's the most complicated name, but basically, Domenico rather, Santa Maria. My enemies in the party, Santa Maria and his organisation, are bitter. They know I loathe the things they stand for, their ruthlessness, their suicidal craving for a holy crusade against the communist heretics. They want to restore the peasantry. Their ideal man is bovinely content, stupidly docile, subservient to the divinely inspired, crazy guidance of leaders whose minds half the time are preoccupied unrealistically and intolerantly with the problems of life after death. So that's Reed's version of Cornwall's thoughts on Santa Maria and Santa Maria's, kind of agenda, I guess, for Australia and for Australian politics. There is a lot more like that. In the case of some of the minor characters, Reed's view of their immorality and corruption are quite sizzling. It's all very entertaining, if a little confusing, because there are simply too many people at times and too many characters in this story. I think Ross Fitzgerald has counted around 30 characters, and they are as confusing as any cast of Russian characters in a Russian novel. Reed obviously could keep track of them because he knew who he was writing about in the narrative, but he does fail really to give them separate identities at times. He needed, of course, to write people out of the history of the split in order to give us a book that would work as a slightly better novel. But he can't resist throwing in yet another state secretary or union organiser. He has met along the way who he wants to really give a drumming to. He does, a much better job on the main players, and because they're modelled so obviously on real people and real action, there's an internal consistency in their behaviour and attitudes. So Call or San Maria, Evett, leap off the page as large as they were in life. Now, there are others in this room who knew them or have read extensively about them. They'll be better judges than I am about the accuracy or not of their characterisation, but it seems to me that Reed's captured them very well. I was just going to read perhaps just a little bit and see whether you can guess who this is about. You know, it's like a blind tasting at a wine tasting. So here it goes. Then he rose to speak. He was a dark man with intense, unhappy eyes. His skin was yellowish, the colour of thin mud. He was tall, over 6 feet, very straight-backed, with wide shoulders and a lean waist. The man spoke slowly and deliberately. He gave an impression of having considerable strength. His voice was firm and cultured, rather thin but compelling. "Who's that character?" Fortune asked, and Fortune is Corwell. "So who's that character?" Corwell asked. "He's got something," and the answer comes back from Machiavelli, in fact, the Reed character. He answers, "Money and a social conscience. He's been around in the party for a while, joined up after the war." So a drink for afterwards for anyone who can guess who that might be. Goff, indeed it was. Goff, no prizes for me as well. Edric, for guessing that one. There's more of the same, and it's actually quite fascinating to me to hear Reed in 1958, just 6 years, I think, after Goff was elected to Parliament, talking about that character who we sort of know so well. And a little later in the book, that Goff character, his name is Tom Bannion, is offered a position in the party machine, and he wrestles with his conscience between whether he should decide to do it and sort of become Corwell's man in this case. And he does. And there's another nice little bit later on where, again, he's talking about, the author says, Bannion, that is Goff, was too painfully earnest for Corwell, Fortune, so too painfully earnest for Corwell, to make him a close henchman. Bannion became too earnest about minor peccadilloes, for Corwell's taste. He had a gift for transforming a minor tactical move into a full-scale crusade. Corwell told him once, if you can win on a narrow front, never extend the battle, you could lose. So that's Reed's view of Goff in those early days. One more, and then we'll give it away. But there's another paragraph, and see if you can guess this one. He considered himself a religious man. He was not particularly concerned with the moral teachings of his church, but he was concerned about the religious symbols that were associated with it. These, by their material presence in his home, gave him the comforting assurance that he was religious without the need for self-examination. Corwell. Yes, indeed it was Corwell. Have you read the book, though?
No, you have to chat with
him. Yeah, all right, good, yeah. And that's exactly the case that is in the book. There's a shrine in the house too. to a dead son, which is a fictional life.
So he died of leukemia.
Oh, he did. All right. Okay. So there you go. Even more facts. That, you know, the more you go on, the more you realise how many facts are actually in there. So that's Corwell. Now, one of the interesting people, of course, and Ross mentioned this, is that Alan Reid writes himself into the book as Macca Kelly, and he writes himself in not as a journalist, but as Corwell's advisor, basically, of sort of effectively like a chief of staff. He positions himself as the insider who consistently, throughout the book, actually operates as an outsider. So he's got one foot in the camp, but he's actually the outsider, the judge, you know, who's more independent. He's the ultimate political player, not so much above the compromises because of politics, because he gets down and dirty, but ultimately above the passion and the beliefs of politics. I think actually there's probably another book to be done in analysing Alan Reid's version of himself in this book as Macca Kelly, and it would be a very interesting interesting read. In fact, Alan, the younger Alan Reid, who's here, and Susan, is it? Susan, might actually find that quite an interesting read, and they sort of read it and think of Macca, not Macca, but of your father. A few other points really about the Bandar Log. We know it's about the split, and of course, and the key elements of the battle between Santa and Evatt followers do emerge clearly, but the novel suffers a little bit from sort of poor structure and a lack of a clear plot line. There are too many incidents that aren't really connected. Some machinations at times, some of the stuff around party politics becomes so slightly mind-numbing, and the action around the split probably should have been introduced earlier, but anyway, whatever it is, it is a great read, despite that. Now, sometimes I think Reid, what's interesting is he forgets he's trying to be a novelist at times and falls back into sort of a journalistic commentary. The statements are interesting, but a more experienced novelist would have wound them into the narrative a little bit more. I'll just give you an example of that, a section on women, and I'll preface it a little by saying a little more about women in the book. Now, Ross said to me the other day, you know, it's a very it's a very sort of old-fashioned book in that sense, because there are hardly any women in it, and the women in it are minor characters. It doesn't particularly worry me, because it really was an era that when Reid simply, people like Reid and men in politics, I suppose, really didn't see women as powerful in any public sense. Secondly, obviously it's a historical fact that there weren't any women at the top of the party and parliament much, really, or the union movement, so they don't feature. So, in a way, Reid does quite a good job of talking about the women who are there. He's quite sympathetic about the wives. Margaret Whitlam appears as Janice in this book, and he's very tall and gracious. Slightly surprisingly, he gives the Corwell character a very rather colourless sort of stay-at-home wife, and I was interested when I actually went to Wikipedia to discover something I didn't know, that Corwell had a very switched-on, intelligent, educated and engaged wife who launched with him an Irish newspaper, in fact, and so she was very different from the character in the book. So anyway, this is just a little example, I think, of Reid again talking about Corwell's attitude to women. He said, and generally about men's attitude towards women at that time in politics. Outside his home, he had no feminine contacts, only political ones. Most party politicians were similarly placed. Some provided opportunities for extramarital sexual activity, but they were usually with tarts or some little typist attached to politics in some way, prone to be impressed by a politician's importance. Those high in the party seldom became involved with women except on a purely physical plane. Their passions were conserved for politics. So, all good stuff. Now, finally, I'm just going to finish with a reference to one of the most successful sections of the book. Well, actually, before I do that, I just wanted to mention that something that Alan Reid's son, said to me just before about his father, and it's interesting because I hadn't realised that Alan Reid loved the bush and loved going to the country when he could and getting away and out of Canberra. And this book actually starts with the Macca Kelly character, who is Alan Reid, on a farm, you know, and sort of the joy of being on the farm, the purity of the farm, and then he goes back into politics, and the rest of the book is absorbed with politics. You don't get any of that sort of in a time away. So I thought that was fascinating to find that, again, something I didn't know. So just to finish with this reference to what I think one of the most successful parts of the sections of the book, actually, where Reid's writing of the very seedy, corrupt underworld of Labour politics. And it's a scene set in a nightclub where a powerful party figure is trying to entrap a lower bedroom on Aparachik so that he can be of use at a later time. And the middle of the action is one of the club dancers who, in effect, has to decide whether she'll do the party boss's bidding and prostitute herself to this labour flunky, or refuse and thus risk losing the patronage of this powerful party boss. It's a really chilling piece of writing and so convincing that it's clear to me that Alan has read, as a journalist, has observed this sort of trade, I suppose, before. And, of course, to me it's a reminder of what Reed was doing in the book. He's not just talking about the split, but he's talking about the sort of moral vacuum of politics. Now, I'll just read you it. I might have to skip a little bit. So this is the girl talking, the dancer. She says, he wants me to go back to his hotel with him. Do I have to, Mr. Lilly? Lilly, the party boss, says, you don't have to do anything, Annette. And Peyton, who's standing there, says, for Christ's sake, Joe, the kid's frightened of the gorilla. And Lilly, the party boss, says, keep your voice down, you're not addressing a public meeting. He glanced across at the hat-check girl. She was reading a paper spread on the counter. She was not paying any attention. He said, his tone kindly, you're nervy, Annette, imagining things. Brock's okay, just happy. But it's quite all right, my dear. I understand. You run along home. I'll explain things to Brock. It'll be a bit embarrassing, but I'll explain. The girl's eyes were miserable. She looked very young and vulnerable. She hesitated. She said, you're sure it's all right, Mr. Lilly? You're sure he's all right, Mr. Lilly? Not crazy or anything? The fat man was reassuring. Of course I'm sure, my dear. I know Brock. He's a nice fellow. She wavered. If you're sure he's all right, Mr. Lilly... She was pathetically anxious to please the fat man. Well, okay then, forget it. I guess I'm just imagining things. She smiled. The smile was unsure. I'll get Brock. I told him I was going to get a rat. You're doing me a favour, Annette, said Lilly softly. I never forget a favour. I shan't forget this one. Thanks, Mr. Lilly, she hesitated. Then with a boldness that Peyton had not expected, she said, about that favour, Mr. Lilly, they're auditioning at the Globe for an understudy for Maria Montez. Lily smiled. He took out a notebook. He scribbled in it. You'll get your audition, my dear. It wouldn't surprise me if you got the job. The men watched the girl sway along the foyer. Her back was straight and supple. A dancer's back. Suddenly, Peyton said to Lily, will she get the job? Sure, said Lily. He slipped the notebook back into his pocket. I always pay off. He looked at Peyton. His eyes were expressionless. This girl will tell others she did a favour for Joe Lilly. She won't say what the favour was, but she'll hint that it was kind of important and it paid off. Though she'll tell will be anxious to do me a favour in the hope of the payoff. It's a form of advertisement. Peyton said, how's it feel to be a procurer, Joe? So it's actually, I've got to say when I read that, I found it really quite an amazing piece, and perhaps it doesn't go over quite so well reading it, but it's that sense of someone like Reed being very in control of understanding the depth of corruption and how that operates. So it is a great book. He was an ace political reporter and player, Alan Reed, but I think segments like that suggest he was also an incredible observer of life. So congratulations to everyone involved in getting this forgotten manuscript into print, and there are copies over here, of course, as well.
Peter. So now we move on to reading about the life of Peter Coleman's memories of a slow learner. Peter, thank you.
Thank you, Gerard. I'm not sure, ladies and gentlemen, who the writer was who said he had to launch his book himself because he couldn't get anybody else to take it on. but thank you, Gerard, and even though my story does have none of the excitements of the Labour split of the 1950s, a good way of reading this book, ladies and gentlemen, is to start with chapter 6, where I recall a meeting in 1955 of the Poetry Society, now defunct, at one of its fortnightly meetings in 217A Lower George Street, which was soon to be bulldozed for the Grand International Hotel at the Four Seasons. The society was run by a fragile, diaphanous woman with the marvellous name of Imogen Wise, spelled W-H-Y-S-E. A number of poets were there, ranging from the prophetic distant Alec Hope to the pallid and noticeably underweight Charles Higham, later to become more famous and better fed, as the best-selling biographer of Hollywood stars Errol Flynn, Marlene Dietrich and others. A number of less likely poetry lovers were there, mainly lawyers, notably Hal Wootton, later to conduct the Royal Commission into Black Deaths in Custody, and John Kerr, already a prominent QC, although not yet the famous figure in Australian politics that he became 20 years later. But the central figure of the occasion was the poet Jim McCauley, and the high point of the meeting was his first public reading of his new poem, A Letter to John Dryden. It's a satire on this vacant, sly, neurotic, modern world, and the various responses to this modern world: Marxism, Islamic fundamentalism, liberal secularism, and Christianity. I strongly recommend the poem if you haven't read it. It was, for me, a moving and unforgettable experience. My first intimation of a deeply felt critique of Australian liberalism wrought by an Australian poet out of Australian experience. It had a lasting influence on me and led me 25 years later to write at the heart of James McCauley. And it is, as I will try to show, one of the keys, perhaps the main key, to Memoirs of a Slow Learner. It may be, reading it may also be a helpful antidote to some of the responses to the 1980 edition of my book. One or two of my reviewers may have been influenced by the cover lines on the 1990 edition, which I didn't write, but the publisher did, an intimate, personal memoir. Well, a number of reviewers complained, expecting an intimate personal memoir, that I was far too reticent. It was quickly plain that I was no confessional poet, compelled to advise readers of my sexual peculiarities and mental aberrations. But the complaint went beyond that. I was too uptight. I seemed afraid to let myself go, said Dick Hughes, the jazz pianist and himself a distinguished autobiographer. Why is there so little about my inner life? Asked John McLaren, then editor of the leftist literary political Overland. Father Eddie Campion, another distinguished autobiographer, found the book too shy, taciturn and dreamy. No thrusting ego here, no raucous self-justification, no setting of old scores, he said. Geoffrey Dutton, poet and critic, found stray references to childhood unhappiness and loneliness, which I pass over at high speed, he says, but which must have gone deep. He is right, but I mean, that wasn't what the book was about. The political commentator Max Teichman also noted the early disappearance of my mother from the story and my total silence about my father's second wife. Other reviewers were closer to what I was trying to do in the book. The poet Patrick Cody and the historian Nicholas Brown, for example, saw that the book is not really an intimate personal memoir. Its real subject matter is the cultural and political turbulence of the 1940s and 1950s, not quite the Alan Reid story, a turbulence that had formed me. According to Jeff Shaw, later a Labour Attorney General in New South Wales, the book is a document of Australian intellectual life. I should have stuck to writing, he said, and not strayed into Parliament. A mistake, he said, when I met him while electioneering, door-knocking his street in suburban Gladesville. The American critic Margaret Beau Burns took this a step further. The point of the book, she said, is the larger life of the mind. Forget about my supposed reticence. Read properly, we learn more about Coleman than we think we do. She believes she found a key in my sketch of Manning Clark, the anguished historian and sage torn between the Catholic Church and the Kremlin. Doug Buckley, a Protestant writing in a Christian magazine, was the most pointed of all. Far from being too reticent, he said, Memoirs of a Slow Learner is amongst the most self-revealing books he'd ever read. Its core is an ardent, quote, an ardent lifelong search for political and spiritual truth. It takes its sympathetic readers on an expedition to the edge of Christianity that stopped short of submission. This fancy high-mindedness irritated some readers. Was it too prissy, ultimately evasive, a little ridiculous? John Douglas Pringle, former editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, in a broadly friendly review, found something comic in the book's excessive earnestness, its magnificent obsession with spiritual truth. While readers will make what they will of these various reactions to the book, reviewers of the new edition, although fewer in number, have been generally sympathetic and, I believe, far more perceptive than many of the reviewers of the 1990 edition. Rebecca Weiser, Ross Fitzgerald, James Murray, Peter Costello, who actually did launch it, son-in-law, and mysterious Daisy May. But let me return to where I started this evening. Looking back across 20 years, I see more clearly than I did at the time that the real origin of Memoirs of a Slow Learner was my immersion in the poetry of James Macaulay, who was my co-editor at Quadrant. His autobiographical poems moved me deeply, especially, as I said, his letter to John Dryden. It distantly echoed a similar family background to mine: free-thinking father, Protestant mother, a similar education in a selective and secular state high school and Sydney University, and an adolescent infatuation with communism, anarchism and mysticism. But whereas Macaulay found a resolution of his quest in the Catholic Church, I persevered with secular liberalism in the belief that imagination and feeling could still moisten its past landscape. Several writers published rejoinders to Macaulay's poem: Jack Lindsay, Amy Whiting, Alec Hope. Memoirs of a Slow Learner was mine. It could be called a letter to James Macaulay. In the years since, I came to accept many of Macaulay's criticisms of my liberal secularism, many but not all. I've also become far more sceptical of the philosophers and free thinkers who influenced me in my youth, and far less sceptical of the churchmen who deplored their influence. I'm thinking there of the great free thinker John Anderson, who was one of my adolescent heroes, and of course Archbishop Gough, if any of you remember him, who was a declared crusader against the influence of Gough. I now think less highly of Anderson and a little more highly of Archbishop Gough. When I finished the first edition of this book, I remained one step ahead of the Hound of Heaven. Am I still on the run? Asked Peter Costello, a Christian, when launching this new edition in Melbourne. One last chapter, he said, is still to be written. That may call for a third edition. In concluding, let me mention an error in this new edition. Not too important, but worth noting. Two facing pages are missing. I blame myself for not checking the proofs more thoroughly. One page has a dedication to my children. Its loss is a disappointment to me and maybe even to my children, but it will not trouble readers at all. But the facing page, also missing, has a stanza from a poem by Jim Macaulay, which I published in the Bulletin in the 1960s. It gives the book its title and something of its theme, and it's a shame that it's missing. The stanza on the missing page: some like me are slow to learn. That's the slow learner. Some like me are slow to learn. What's plain can be mysterious still. Feelings alter, fade, return, but love stands constant in the will. Thank you.
Ross, we're going to go to questions and discussion as we're getting the three speakers can stand up here. It's the easiest way. If I repeat your comment, it's because I think we can't pick it up in the microphones here. Before I start, I should say Janet Grun has got copies of The Bounder Log, edited by Ross Fitzgerald, copies of Madeline, written by Helen Drinker, and copies of Memoirs, the latest edition of Memoirs of a Slow Learner by Peter Coleman, and I'm sure our three speakers will be happy to sign books today. So we've got a lot of people here, we don't have a lot of time, so let's be brief with our comments and responses. So first to Peter, as I recall from reading your book, you too have an unpublished novel. Now, what would you say if someone like a latter-day Rosser's juror turned up 60 years after your death and published it? Peter, come back in.
First of all, it wouldn't happen because it's so bad that they were so lacking in interest. Whereas the point is that Alan Reid wanted and tried hard, dealing with three publishers, his employer, who said they weren't in the business of losing money and weren't prepared to publish it. That was Frank Packer's Consolidated Press. And the second one, Angus and Robinson, who said it was defamatory, and the third one, who had trouble with the printer. So Alan tried hard to get it published. And he would have been pleased that Ross discovered it and, through various helpers, got it published. No one's going to publish mine. I really don't have to worry about that. But at my age, perhaps, Gerard, I should destroy it.
Right, so while you're there, what do you think of Reid's book? I mean, you knew Alan, didn't you?
Yes, well, I thought it was, and the parts that Alan read, it is excellent in its little characterisation. I think that's Alan Reid, the political observer. I think as a novel, as a story, it's very wooden, very creaky, and too didactic. I think it's a failure as a novel, and it attracted publishers, at least until they dropped it, because it told an inside story by an insider of this dramatic chapter in Australian politics. So that holds its interest, but I don't think it's a good novel. And even today, I'm not quite in agreement with Helen Trinker, who really, in her speech, was almost persuaded me that I was wrong, and I should go back and try to read it again. But Alan was a terrific journalist. I don't think he was a perfect journalist. He sometimes, as Helen said, he was a player sometimes. I think that he may have bent over backwards to sometimes to appeal to please his employers in his political targets. It's a shame.